I thought, what would be better than to use my 34 years in the veterinary industry than to help you guys, the pet owner? What are your questions? What do you need to know? What would you like to know? I want to create a completely interactive podcast where you, the listener, can ask your questions and we will answer them. I will have industry-leading professionals come in and have conversations about your very questions. What keeps you up at night? What worries you about your pet? What worries you about the cost of taking care of your animal? There's so many things that we can talk about, but I need you to tell me what we need to come up with. Because if you do that, we can have a great, great, great session.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Irreplaceable Tales. I am Mallory Dickinson, RVT. Today we have Dr. Ken Ramirez with us. As you've heard Dr. G say many times, we like to have industry-leading experts on our team here, and Ken is definitely one of those. Ken, I'll let you introduce yourself a little bit here.
Sure. Hello, Mallory. My name is Ken Ramirez, and I am the Executive Vice President and Chief Training Officer for Karen Pryor Clicker Training. I oversee the Karen Pryor Academy program, which is the largest and one of the most respected positive reinforcement professional dog training certification organizations in the world.
We are so excited to have you here. Our viewers have a lot of training questions for you, so we'll jump right in here if you don't mind.
Sure.
A big question we got actually a lot of was, what are the most common training mistakes pet owners make?
I think the biggest mistake that people make is this desire to want to punish their dogs. I think when it's understandable, we grow up in a society that is very used to punishing. Our parents, our teachers, our coaches tell us no, wrong, stop, don't do that. And so it makes sense to us as trainers or as dog guardians that if we see our dog doing something wrong, we would like to punish that behavior so that they don't do it again. And there's a logic to that. But one of the challenges that comes with punishment is the potential for destroying the relationship that you have with your dog, to make your dog afraid of wanting to interact with you. And sometimes, unfortunately, when our dogs are doing something wrong, often the severity of our punisher is hard to stop. In other words, we lash out of anger, out of frustration, and we can actually injure our dogs or cause them harm. And so I really try to caution people about allowing their unbridled frustration let out of them and taking it out on the dog. The most important thing we can do as trainers, punishment doesn't do that. Punishment actually can hurt that relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that it's getting better? Do you think more recently people have kind of engaged more and kind of embraced this fear-free, or not fear-free, but, you know, positive reinforcement with training?
Yes, that's a great question, Mallory. I've seen the tide surge in the direction of using positive reinforcement more frequently. I think 50 years ago, as I was starting out in this field, it was rare to see dog trainers thinking a lot about the use of positive reinforcement. It was used, but it wasn't a leading necessarily way to train. Punishment was very, very common. And I would say in the last two or three decades, the movement has been toward more and more positive reinforcement training. However, I think so often raising a dog is a lot like parenting. And as a parent, there are dozens and dozens of different parenting styles. And you can't really say that there's a specific parenting style that doesn't work. All of them clearly work. We somehow get through our childhoods and we go on to lead hopefully fruitful and productive lives, whether we had permissive parents, strict parents, or whatever kind of parents that we raised. I think we as humans are very resilient. And I think dogs, because they have been bred to live with people, have also learned to be quite resilient. And so the dogs can come out okay. And in the end, it isn't always a question of how were they trained as much as what you focused on and what you tried to train. And so people have a lot of different styles of approaching training. We at Care and Prior Academy just really push toward thinking about positive reinforcement and thinking about how to use it effectively to teach your dogs what you want them to do. And when it comes to pets misbehaving, oftentimes we want to reach out and punish our dogs for doing an inappropriate behavior. But if they haven't been taught what the right behavior is, they don't know what to do. They're just being punished without any opportunities to show you the correct behavior. What we try to do with positive reinforcement is show dogs, here's the way we want you to behave in this situation, and we will reinforce it well so that the dog will want to do the correct behavior instead of the incorrect behavior, or I don't like to call it the incorrect behavior, but the behavior that we wish they wouldn't do.
Do you think you've seen in the I'm an RVT. I've been in vet med for a little over 20 years. And I think there's definitely been a shift too, even in veterinary medicine, with kind of my parents' generation, the older generations. They, animals lived in the backyard. Dogs were backyard pets. They weren't allowed in the house. They weren't allowed to sleep in beds. Do you think some of the shift with wanting people to do positive reinforcement has to do with now that they are no longer, they're now considered family members as opposed to backyard pets? Do you think they're starting to, there's any correlation with those two?
I think there is, but it may not be as direct a correlation as we think. But I think what has happened, I agree, I grew up in an era where dogs were usually lived outside, and we may let them in the house for 30 minutes once in a while to play with them. But most of the time they slept outside, they ate outside, they exercised outside.
Yeah.
And sadly, I think what has happened is I don't have a problem with people having their dogs live inside. My dogs live inside with me. I understand that, but I think what ends up happening is when dogs live outdoors, we accept the fact that they behave like dogs. But when they start living indoors, we start putting these social conventions on them, like you don't want them to pee and poop indoors. You don't want them to dig up things. You don't want them to chew things. You don't want them to bark at things. All of the things that are such natural behaviors for dogs, they keep doing when you bring them inside, but for a lot of reasons, we don't want those behaviors inside. Those are irritating to us. So we are really trying to teach the dogs not to behave like dogs and behave what we consider to be appropriately for living among humans. And I get that. I understand that. But I think it makes dogs' lives more difficult, and our expectations are much higher. And thus, training becomes much more important. That's why people go to dog trainers. Usually they don't hire dog trainers until they have a problem. And it's usually because they would like them to quit chewing their shoes. They would like them to quit barking at the postman or whatever. There's behaviors they would like to see changed. And the sad thing is, of course, that so often those things we want to change are such natural behaviors for dogs. And so I think the move to having more and more dogs living in an urban lifestyle and living in our houses and in our apartments and in our condos suddenly puts a lot of pressure on dogs to be successful at living up to the standards that we have set for them.
Absolutely. I have a Frenchie pity mix at home, and we always call it yelling at the neighbors. Yeah. She has learned how to open our blinds. So she pulls down on the blinds, they open up so she can yell it at the neighbors when they walk by. But in her mind, she's protecting us, right? She's standing her ground. This is her house. These are her people. But like you said, it's annoying. We're like, oh my gosh, you just yell at the neighbors all the time. But like you said, it's what, if she was outside, we wouldn't have as big of a problem with it, right?
Yeah, it's the big challenge. And it's the reason why there are so many dogs that are put up for adoption in the U.S. every year. People bring a dog into their home and they have these high expectations of them behaving a specific way. And then when they don't, if they can't fix it quickly, if they can't find a solution, they're often very quick to take the dog to the local shelter.
Right.
And the latest statistics I've seen are in the millions of dogs and cats are euthanized or taken to shelters in the U.S. every
yeah.
single year.
Yeah, it's the numbers are just astounding, right? I mean, how do you think, I'm totally going off. going off on a tangent here. How big of a difference do you think it would make if these shelters had the resources or if these rescue groups had the resources to implement behavioral changes or implement training or implement things that might help these dogs out? Or is it back to these age-old question, you know, are there just too many pets and not enough homes?
No, I think there's a couple of different answers to the question. And I think one of the things that would be helpful is if more and more shelters had complete behavior departments. There are many that do. There are many excellent shelters that have a behavior division. And in many cases, you are not allowed to take the dog home until you sign up for one of their free classes. And they'll even give you free classes on how to get started training a pet so that you can set your dogs up for success. And I think it would be great if there were more and more shelters that had a behavior department. There are other shelters that have a behavior department, but they tend to work with behavioral problems as opposed to getting people off to a good start. But I think a lot of shelters are trying to do the right thing and they're trying to educate dog owners. And a big part of that is helping dog owners recognize the responsibility of taking on a pet into your home. Most
right.
of the time, we recognize that if you're going to get a pet, that you're going to need to feed it good food. And we recognize that you're going to probably need a good veterinarian. We recognize a lot of things sort of come along with having a pet in your home. Sadly, one of the things that is listed as a prerequisite isn't usually find a good trainer. They only think, well, I only need a good trainer either if I'm training a new puppy, if I have a dog problem, a behavior problem, or maybe if I want to participate in a sport like agility or obedience, then I'll get a good trainer.
Right.
I wish people would recognize, just like they recognize I need a vet on call and need a veterinary hospital that I can go to if my dog is sick or if I need vaccinations or if I just want to check on the health of my pet, everybody recognizes the need to call a veterinarian. I wish they also recognized the need to bring a training expert, a behaviorist, a trainer on board right from the very start.
I mean, I have my trainer on speed dial. I'll tell you that. I mean, it's a great resource to have. It really is.
Sure.
How do you feel about people, or I guess the next question would be people who want to adopt a dog, how important is it for them to know or purchase a dog? How important is it for them to know the breed and what they're getting into? How much do you think that plays into trainability, behavioral issues, or what the owners might see as behavioral issues?
Yeah. I have a lot of opinions on that, and I'll start by saying I'm not a big believer in what I call breed bias, meaning
okay.
I don't necessarily subscribe to the idea that this particular breed makes a bad pet and this particular breed always makes a good pet.
Yeah.
But I do think that there are certainly breed characteristics that we need to be aware of. In other words, if you live in a condo in a downtown city like New York City, Chicago, etc., I'm not sure that a border collie is the right choice because a border collie is bred to be a herding species. And so consequently, they like to herd, they like to chase after things, they like to pursue things. And so you're going to have a dog who really, really needs a lot of exercise. So unless you're going to make sure that you have a dog walker or someone in your home who can take the dog outside and make sure they get a chance to exercise. And when I say exercise, keeping in mind that taking your dog out for a walk on a leash in the city is not exercise. It's a little bit of exercise, but not when it comes to being a border collie.
Right.
And so I think it is important that you take into account the breed that you're going to get. Even if it's things like this particular breed sheds a lot and you happen to know that someone in your household is very concerned about hair all over the furniture and hair everywhere, and you are going to find yourself in a situation where that member of the family is not going to be happy because
Right.
there's hair everywhere. And most dogs do shed, but there are some that shed much less than others. And so I do think it's important to be thoughtful about the breed and thinking about where you live, what the conditions that you live in. And, you know, and if you live in a tiny apartment, perhaps having a Great Dane isn't the right choice for you just because of the size of the dog. And so while I don't like breed biases, I do think being well informed about what is natural for this particular breed, what is it that this breed does commonly, what was it bred for? You know, some were bred for using their nose, and some were bred for herding and guarding livestock, and others were bred for other things. And so I do think understanding a little bit about the breed and understanding what's most natural for that breed is a very, very important thing.
Yeah. I mean, even something as simple, if you have a bunch of little kids running around the house, a breeding dog that's going to be nipping at ankles might not be ideal for a house of little kids, right? I mean,
but you see it happen a lot, and then that becomes
But then that dog's a biter.
Yes,
right. It turns into
gets a reputation for being a biter, being a problem.
He's
trying to herd my kids, and then you have this difficult situation, particularly if the dog has been with you for any amount of time. You've become attached to that dog.
Yeah.
And so that's where you start running into these behavioral problems, and you feel like you need to find a way to fix them. I'm a big believer in fixing the problem before it becomes a problem. And so doing a lot of proactive work. And that's why I think it's good to get a trainer on board right away. However, I realize that if we did that, trainers would be more focused on proactive training as opposed to reactive training, which is, all right, tell me what problems you have and let's figure out how to fix them. And that's the problem that people, the situation that people find themselves in all the time now.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Another question that we got a little bit of was, what are the first commands every dog should learn, in your opinion?
Yeah, and I it's very specific to a situation that you're living in. When I think about cues that I want my dog to know, I want my dog to respond quickly if I need him to. So a good recall, a good come behavior, so that you can get him or her to you quickly and out of danger if they are in danger. To me, that is really, really important. If you live in the city where you are going to have to walk your dog on a leash, then I think you want to have a dog that's trained to wear a good collar or wear a good harness, and that the dog is able to walk on a lead. I'm not super strict about thinking that a dog needs to do excellent loose leash walking, but there is something to be said for if you have a 80-pound Labrador retriever, super friendly dog, but when he gets excited, he can pull your arm out of your socket. And so being able to teach a dog to stay by your side, it's okay if they sniff a little bit and smell what's around them, but they are not pulling the leash out of your arm. So coming when called, good leash walking skills, just meaning that they will stay close to you, won't trip other people as they're walking by. Those skills become much more critical if you live in the city than if you live out in the country. You know, in the country, you can probably put your dog in the backyard and let them run as much as they want. But if you're in the city, you're probably not allowed to do that. You're probably required to have that dog on leash and keep it on a short leash. And so having a dog that's comfortable walking on a lead is really, really important. I also think, for me, I would train a number of behaviors that help gain control of the dog. Meaning, it's sort of preventing potential problems by simply having things that can teach your dog to sit, to lay down, to touch a target or touch your hand when you ask them to. And by doing those things, it can pull them out of the way. It can get them to stay put for a minute. Those kinds of things can be really helpful as well. But again, I don't think that these are the essential five, but I think that you should consider where you're living and what it is you're going to need to do with this dog so that you can have him living comfortably in areas that you live in. I also think that if you're living in a big city, if you're living in an environment where there are certain noises or things that cause your dog to want to bark and chase things, there's some desensitization activities, some preparation for living in those environments that can help set those dogs up for success so that they're not being terrorized all the time by cars going by or bicycles going by or whatever they have to contend with in their environment. And so there's a lot of things that I think can be helpful. I often ask what it is you need that dog to be able to do. And I think one other thing that I think is critical that I wish we included were required if you were going to adopt a dog or get a dog, that you learned a little bit about body language. In other words, just simple things so that you could see by looking at your dog, oh, he looks distressed right now, or oh, he looks happy and comfortable right now. Because by reading the dog's body language, a pet guardian can make so much better decisions about what's happening in that dog's life. And I think too often we still believe the myth that if the dog's tail is wagging, he must be happy. Mm-hmm. When realistically, there's so many more things that we should be looking for. I often see that dogs will let you know that they're uncomfortable. And it's when you don't react appropriately to that uncomfortableness that they then begin to growl or bark or do other things, because they show you a little sign, like their hair goes up on the end or their eyes get wide. But if you don't know to read that that's a sign of stress and uncomfortableness, you just keep doing what you're doing. And if you don't change what you're doing, you put that dog into an uncomfortable situation, and they have learned that the only way to get your attention is to growl or bark, and then that you will usually do something and take them out of that situation. Right, you take them out of that situation because you need to for your own safety and peace of mind. But from their perspective, they're going, oh, thank God my person finally realized I wanted out of this situation.
But I had to put on a whole show for them to respond.
Right. Yes.
I thought was kind of interesting, is what are your thoughts on shock collars?
You know, I understand why people use shock collars, but I am really, really drastically, dramatically, I don't know what word to use, opposed to their use. And, you know, when you think about the reason a shock collar was invented, it was invented to cause pain. It was invented to cause discomfort. And I recognize that people who know how to use a shock collar can stop behavior in its tracks. But as I would often say to a person, you know, yes, it'll stop behavior in its tracks, but it can cause harm. It can cause distrust. And so I really, really am always looking for how can we move away from using a shock collar. There are extreme situations where people will get themselves into, but even the most extreme situation I have seen handled without the use of pain and discomfort. But yeah, shock collar will stop behavior, but oftentimes at what expense? And so usually if you've gotten to that extreme where you feel like a shock collar is needed, I always say you probably should have started sooner. But even if you hadn't started, even though you didn't start sooner, there are ways to manage the situation and then eventually train alternative responses or alternative behaviors with that dog. So in many ways, I applaud countries like the UK and a few others that have outlawed even the selling of shock collars, because you can't get one in certain countries. And it's because of the discomfort that it causes. And I know that there are those who will say, yes, but there's different settings and you can put it on the most mild of settings. But my experience has been that as humans, we just, when we are upset, when we are unhappy with behavior, there's this tendency, yeah, we might say, no, please don't do that. And then the second time we say no a little harsher, and then we say it really loudly, and then we lash out. And what happens is when you have those dials on the shock collar, there's this tendency for people to turn up that dial, and where it's causing legitimate pain, where you can actually see and hear the dogs yelping in discomfort when it's used. But will it stop behavior? Yeah, it will. Just like if someone threatened me and punched me in the nose,
yeah,
it's going to keep me from wanting to go in there. Now, depending on my temperament, it may cause me to retaliate and fight back. Those are what causes, it's things like that that cause dogs to become more aggressive, that lash back out. But they may not lash back out at their owner. They may lash out at somebody else. It's called displacement. But what happens is they're frustrated, and often the thing that they're barking at is the thing that they recognize. Oh, when I see another dog, the shock happens. You're shocking them because you don't want them to bark.
Right.
They recognize the shock happened because that other dog appeared. It causes them to bark more. It causes them to want to attack. And so I could go on and on about the risks of shock collars, but I would love it if they were outlawed. I think that there are so many other ways to get desired behavior. We don't need to inflict pain on our dogs, and we don't have to potentially hurt them. And as someone who works in a veterinary hospital, I'm sure you've probably seen some of these cases where people have used aversives so severely that the dogs are injured and they have to come in to have
You see the burn marks. Sometimes they leave the collars on and they're like embedded because they're like, well, I can't take it off because I don't trust them if it's not on. And you're just,
It's one of those things that I don't think people hear those stories. And I know others that have gone, okay, I won't use a shock collar, but they'll use a hard jerk on the leash. And I've had veterinarians explain to me that they've had dogs come in with necks that have been dislocated and animals that are really injured. And it doesn't necessarily take a super strong person to cause that kind of injury, especially to a small dog. And it's just, if it was up to me, I would take those tools out of the hands of the average dog owner. I just feel like they are, that while I have seen experienced trainers use them with skill, it is really difficult to teach a regular dog guardian how to use those tools skillfully and not cause pain and discomfort. So I am really opposed to the use of those tools.
And I always worry too, my dog is, you know, she's slightly reactive. And, you know, my husband at one point was like, oh my gosh, we should get a shock collar. And I was like, no is my answer. But I tried explaining to him too. Part of my concern is I don't know where she's going to redirect that energy too, right? Like, yes, it may stop her dead in her tracks.
Very well may.
Or she's now trauma. She's very sensitive as well as being reactive. You know, so who knows? Now is she going to be mad at us? Is she going to be mad at the world? Is this even going to register with her? Is she going to turn around and bite someone because she's reacting to the collar? Like, it just, I don't know. Yeah.
There are a lot of bad things that come from the use of those kind of aversive tools. And yes, we are reinforced as users because we see the behavior we don't like stops, but we don't recognize that other behavior takes its place. And sometimes it's very unwanted behavior. And I even understand why people use them. One of the things that I'm fairly well known for is I work really hard in the areas where people have rattlesnakes. They want to do a snake avoidance protocol. And probably one of the more popular snake avoidance protocols is to use a shock collar. And people will say, even the most kind, compassionate individual will say, this is the only time I will use a shock collar. They will say, I would rather see my dog shocked once or twice and teach them to avoid rattlesnakes than allow them to get bitten and possibly killed by a rattlesnake.
Right.
And I totally get that. I grew up in New Mexico. I grew up in rattlesnake country.
Yeah.
But believe it or not, you can teach dogs to avoid rattlesnakes using positive reinforcement. You just have to know the techniques to do it. And the people who have trained their dogs using positive reinforcement, it's changed their lives. It's amazing to them that their dogs gleefully run away from a snake and come back to them, don't get bitten, but they didn't have to use a shock collar to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that is amazing.